Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
When the Soviet Union occupied Afghanistan, the CIA funneled aid to resistance fighters from throughout the Arab world, some of whom embraced radical Islamist ideologies that found their ultimate expression in groups like Al-Qaeda after Soviet troops withdrew. Today, we have civil war in Syria, and critics worry that U.S. support for Islamist groups labeled moderate in their resistance to the Assad regime may be inadvertently arming extremists, up to and including Al-Qaeda affiliates. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. A major factor in all this is our affiliation with Saudi Arabia, which is eager to crush Bashar al-Assad, who has been supported by Saudi Arabia's sworn enemy, Iran. Andrew Coburn is here to talk about all this. He is Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and author of the book Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. His article in the current issue of Harper's is called A Special Relationship. The United States is teaming up with Al-Qaeda again. Andrew, welcome back to Think.
Hi, good to be with you.
You opened the story back in 1988 with an American Foreign Service officer stationed in Kabul who reports back to Washington about this terrorist attack on civilians. Why did the CIA want him to shut up about that?
Because it was a car bomb in a civilian area of Kabul that killed and wounded a lot of people, a very poor area, totally civilian. And he reported it, as you say, dutifully back to Washington. And he got a notice that he was to stop doing that because the bomb was the work of a character called Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was one of the leading Afghan quote-unquote resistance fighters sponsored by the CIA, if not the leading one. And it was his terror campaign endorsed and supplied and equipped by the CIA that had, you know, that had led to this terrorist bomb. And the CIA certainly didn't want the rest of the Washington bureaucracy knowing that it was sponsoring a terrorist operation in the Afghan capital.
And it wasn't like just a gray area with Hekmatyar. He was doing bad things to civilians and had been for a long time, but he happened to convince, I suppose, the CIA that he might also do bad things to the Soviets.
Right, he did. I mean, he'd been, it looks like he was actually in receipt of some kind of CIA assistance since the early 70s. And there could have been no mistaking about what sort of person he was, because he was a very hard over sort of fanatical Islamist, such as we know more about today. And they were rare, seemed to be rarer then. But he liked to throw acid in girls' faces if they thought they weren't properly covered up and things like that. And he'd been in receipt of, you know, American funding even before the Soviets intervened. In fact, it was that sort of support to him and other people like him that led to the Soviet intervention, which was the actual policy of Zbigniew Brzezinski, the Carter administration's national security advisor. So it wasn't, you know, it was all, it wasn't like people were making mistakes here. They knew exactly who they were dealing with.
Let's be clear on this. You note in the piece you just noted there that U.S. support for Afghan rebels began before the Soviet invasion in 1979 and helped induce the Soviet invasion. What in the world was the justification for that?
Well, it was the days of the Cold War, and Zbigniew Brzezinski, particularly the national security advisor, I said he had this idea. Well, it was really payback. I guess we'd call it payback for Vietnam. You know, the Russians had supported the other side in Vietnam, and by God, we were going to give the Russians their own Vietnam. And Afghanistan looked like a very sort of very opportune place to do it. In fact, I mean, there's been no secret about this. Brzezinski himself admitted it. He gave what is now a rather infamous interview to a French magazine a few years ago, where he said that the President Carter had signed the first directive for secret aid to the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul 6 months before the invasion. And I'm quoting Brzezinski directly here. And that very day, Brzezinski said, I wrote a note to the president in which I explained to him that, in my opinion, this aid was going to induce a Soviet military intervention. And as I point out, the war that followed, the war he wanted, killed 1 million Afghans. and, you know, led to so much since. So there was a very deliberate policy on the part of the Carter administration to provoke a Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and indeed by supporting people of a kind that we are now fighting, or we say we're fighting against today.
Okay, so 1 million Afghans killed in that war that followed the Soviet invasion. From a U.S. perspective, as these things are wont to go, the CIA's assistance to Afghan rebels might have just been tucked into the history books. But then after 9/11, there was really no ignoring this question of whether we had created a monster somehow.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's kind of the CIA has been very keen to brush that under the carpet ever since. Their standard cover story has been for years, yes, there was some, you know, our aid ended up with some pretty unpleasant people like Hekmatyar, but that was really nothing to do with us because we only worked through the Pakistanis. You know, we just handed over everything to the Pakistanis and sort of walked away, this, the inference. And it was up to the Pakistanis to decide who got the money and the weapons. Well, that's, on the face of it, that's nonsense anyway. There's the United States of America really going to sort of take a hands-off attitude on something like this? And in fact, we know from direct testimony of the people at the time. For instance, one of my favorite quotes is Charlie Wilson. I remember who was the star of was portrayed in that great Tom Hanks film, Charlie mm-hmm. Wilson's War, very colorful and very indeed engaging character from Texas. But Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, this monstrous character I was discussing earlier, he was asked after the war was over, do you remember a congressman called Charlie Wilson? And a beatific smile crossed over his face and he said, oh, yes, he was a good friend. He was all the time supporting our jihad. And actually, the day that Gulbuddin had been asked that question, he'd actually, as it so happened, had beheaded half a dozen people who and irritated him somehow. And he would have had nothing to learn from ISIS. So, yes, there was a question, especially after in 1993, when people who had been part of our supported Afghan, U.S.-supported Afghan jihad tried to blow up the World Trade Center and did manage to kill six people, but, they wanted to bring the whole thing down. And that did raise some awkward questions about who exactly we've been dealing with. But as I say, this cover story sort of swung into effect, even though people at the time, and I've talked to some of the American officials who I talked to in, working on this piece, they were warning back then in the 1980s, saying, oh, my God, who are you supporting? What kind of a monster are you creating now? Like you quoted, Mr. McWilliams, who warned about who was told not to report the terrorist outrages that our guys were letting off in Afghanistan. So, it's a very unholy, longstanding relationship.
Interestingly, Andrew, as you report it, Hekmatyar and his jihadis were not even especially effective at driving out the Soviets. They were so happy to use those U.S.-provided weapons to challenge rival warlords locally.
Right. They were, and this was commented on at the time there were some, what we'd call today sort of, moderate rebels who were doing most of the fighting and were getting the very thin end of whatever supplies were coming through. And they said, watch out, because what Hekmatyar and others, he's not the only one like that, what they're doing is hoarding all their weapons to use against us and against each other once the Soviets have gone. And that indeed is exactly what happened. And that's really that destroyed Kabul in the fighting for the capital that happened in the early 90s and basically destroyed the country, which led to or was followed by the Taliban takeover and, everything else that followed since.
All right. So what did Hekmatyar then have in common with Islamists operating today, ostensibly on the right side of the conflict in Syria, at least from the U.S. perspective, which is to say against the Bashar al-Assad regime?
Well, that's right. Again, it's, we decide, the objective then was get rid of the Soviets by whatever means. And now today the directive, has been get rid of Assad by whatever means. And the easiest way to do it back then, We gravitated to Hekmatyar because, you know, he was, there was no doubt about him. And, you know, also the Pakistanis were indeed very happy with him. He was their candidate too. And the Saudis loved him. So it was all the easy way to do it without thinking too much about the consequences. Today, I mean, originally there was a sort of notion that there were these, and there were indeed, you know, as there had been in Afghanistan, some sort of secular type. So, you know, didn't want to sort of lock all the women in the country up and abolish higher education in Syria. But again, the easy thing to do, and very quickly, and this happened much faster than people realize, was to go with the flow to, you know, the people who want to fight, the people who, you know, that are getting plenty of money anyway from the Saudis and the Qataris, are the people we should be backing. They seem to be the effective ones. They're the people the Turks like. And so, and I talked to, I mean, in the piece, I should have quoted them more, but I did talk to sort of secular types who complained that right from the beginning, you know, they got nothing from the US. I mean, they got a few tins of, you know, a few MREs, and that was hard. They had a chap here in Washington on behalf of the Free Syrian Army who was, I remember he was trying to get warm socks, at least for the men in Syria, and got nowhere. And, you know, just somehow all the weapons and the money flowed to people like Jabhat al-Nusra, which everyone should know is really al-Qaeda. I mean, you know, they acknowledge it. It was al-Qaeda had a policy when al-Qaeda started to get rather a bad name after, sometime after 9/11, particularly because of what al-Qaeda in Iraq was doing in the around 2006, they adopted a policy of sort of PR policy of let's conceal ourselves a bit and let's change our names, you know, in different countries. So
it's like the Al-Qaeda Philip Morris branch, rebrand. Excuse me for interrupting.
Absolutely a rebrand. Yeah. In fact, they talked about a rebranding strategy just before he was killed. Bin Laden was discussing, you know, things they should do, including name change. He actually considered jettisoning the al-Qaeda name altogether, and he had a number of rather, I can't remember what they were now, they all sounded pretty silly, names he had in mind. But in Syria, they became Jabhat al-Nusra. They also, another group of al-Qaeda people called themselves Arar al-Sham, and so on, I could go on. But they are the people who've been in receipt of a massive amount of U.S. weaponry, some of it supplied, the bulk of that supplied through Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey. Others sort of, I don't think you'd ever find a consignment that's gone straight from the CIA to Jabhat al-Nusra, but it goes to little groups that are referred to as Free Syrian Army, you know, good fellows, probably believe in the Constitution, read the works of Thomas Jefferson or what have you. But they are just basically embedded units in these larger sort of jihadi organizations. And we saw that last year when that coalition had a very successful offensive in Western Syria.
Andrew Coburn is my guest. He's Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, which has just published his article, A Special Relationship: The United States is Teaming Up with Al-Qaeda Again. He's also author of a book called Kill Chain: The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Harper's Magazine Washington editor Andrew Coburn. His most recent article is called A Special Relationship. The United States is teaming up with al-Qaeda again. It's in the Current issue. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, Andrew, this is, at least for me, a little bit complicated, so I want to make sure and jump back in history so that we have a full understanding of what we're talking about. How did Arab fundamentalists find their way to the fighting in Afghanistan, which, you know, ostensibly did not concern them?
Well, there was a very extensive organization, a system set up to get them there, to recruit them and to send them over there, which included, extended to this country.
This was astonishing to me.
Yeah, there's the leader of the Arab Mujahideen, he's called the father or the prince of the Mujahideen, as he was called, of the that was what the Arab fighters were called, was a chap called Abdullah Azam, who was actually a Palestinian from Jordan. And he was, by all accounts, a very charismatic character. And he set out to recruit this, you know, Arab legion to go fight in Afghanistan alongside the Afghans. And he recruited in a whole bunch of countries, including this one. And in fact, he had a whole recruitment network, a sort of front offices in this country, centered in Brooklyn, at a mosque on Atlantic Avenue. And he made numerous trips to this country, and he'd go around speaking at mosques and at colleges and everything. I think he spoke in 28 states altogether. And the interesting thing has been, this was all open. No one turned a blind eye to this. It was officially encouraged because it was all, you know, we were right behind the jihad. And, you know, the fact that this, you know, this fundamentalist was recruiting sort of jihadi fighters didn't sort of bother anyone very much until some of them came back and tried to blow up the World Trade Center, as I said earlier. But it wasn't. The interesting part of it is, or another interesting part of it is that there was also a very, even more extensive program in places like Saudi Arabia and Yemen and North Africa. And the recruitment there was twofold. One was, you know, yes, we need recruits. You know, we need more sort of cannon fodder to throw into the battle with the Soviets. But also, this was a very good way for Arab regimes to get rid of troublemakers. One of them explained, I quote in the article, Abu Hamza, who's now doing life for various terrorism charges, he explained it was a vent. He said that they wanted to get rid of people like me. He's an Egyptian. They wanted to get rid of people like me who might cause trouble at home later on. They'd send us off to Afghanistan and, you know, hopefully get killed, you know, while serving their purposes. But of course, as, you know, we and those regimes have found out since, the vent went two-way. Right. I mean, they came back. They didn't all get killed. And people like Abu Hamza came back and promoted terrorism and many others besides, including, you know, people who are still fighting in Syria.
So you send off your fundamentalist hotheads to fight elsewhere. They may or may not get killed. But the idea is that they're going to focus on that conflict rather than, you know, directing their ire at things that displease them at home.
Exactly.
Is it fair to characterize Osama bin Laden as one of those?
Yes. Well, they regarded Osama. I mean, in Saudi, it's very complicated with Osama bin Laden as to what degree I don't know that he would have been regarded at that time as among the more dangerous people. You know, after all, he was a member of the sort of ruling, close to the ruling caste. It's an open question as how close he was to Saudi intelligence at the time. You know, he, for a long time, he was in the shadow. He was really the sidekick to this guy, Azam, I was talking about. But he was very much, you know, after he had, you know, there was a lot of support. This is very, as you said, it is complicated because it wasn't like totally cynical. The Saudis, they wanted to fight the Soviets. They were paying, as I mentioned in the article, they paid 40% of the bill. For the war in Afghanistan, they every year, this is a former CIA senior CIA official explained to me that Bill Casey, who was then the director of the CIA, a very hardline Cold Warrior, would go off on what he called his annual Hajj to Saudi Arabia to ask for the check. And, you know, after a lot of palaver, they'd get it. But he said, in the meantime, we'd have to sit back and listen to all the Saudis' really stupid ideas for how to fight the war. So, yeah, Bin Laden was part of that. And then after the war, they kicked him out of Saudi Arabia because they realized he was trouble. But again, it was kind of an ambivalent attitude.
So what happened to all of these fighters after the Soviets withdrew?
Well, you know, a lot of them went back. A lot of them did go back to Saudi Arabia and actually started mounting quite a sort of energetic jihad against the regime there, which was ruthlessly crushed. A lot of them went back to the Yemenis, went back to Yemen and formed the basis, were used by the regime there, by President Saleh. He used them as kind of his shock troops to take over South Yemen and sort of crush opposition there. So he found them useful, and they then, you know, went on to become Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. A lot of them went back to Egypt, and that was led to a very very energetic and fairly bloody for a while Islamist uprising, sort of terror campaign in Egypt in the mid-90s, early and mid-90s, which was, I quote in the article, I was in 1994, I visited Egypt, and I was actually the president's national security advisor, a chap called Osama al-Baz. And we were discussing what was going on, bombs going off everywhere and so forth. And he said, it's all the fault of those cruder language than this, but the stupid CIA, he said, you know, they set these people up in business and they kept them going. This is the interesting part, I thought. He said they kept them going after the Soviets have withdrawn. And now we get this. He suggested that this group of sort of Arab extremists had been kept in being in order for use against Iran. I've never found confirmation from the CIA side that was true, but they certainly did continue to exist. And someone, at least, certainly wanted to use them against Iran. But it's one of the many mysteries surrounding this.
Andrew, is it going too far to say that smart observers might have predicted that, you know, extremists that we armed in Afghanistan might someday have turned their sights on Western targets?
It's not going too far at all. Smart observers said exactly that. Benazir Bhutto, she said in 1993, she predicted exactly this. She said, you know, in a way, let's be fair to the CIA, they never expected that this would happen, because this is already happening, because this is after the first World Trade Center bomb, that these people they had fostered would come back and, you know, be causing such terrible trouble for them. There was a very brave Afghan, you know, resistance fighter called Abdul Haq, who at the time was continually complaining during the war, during the 80s, and he would complain to Ed McWilliams of the State Department, who was saying the same thing. He was a smart to name two more smart observers who were saying, predicting exactly this. Abdul Haq said, what are you doing? You're creating monsters. You're creating monsters who are going to come and, you know, come and attack you. I mean, this is completely insane what you're doing. So it's certainly fair to say, I mean, it was obvious, certainly to those people on the ground, what was going to happen, as indeed it did.
So what sort of support are we Americans providing directly or indirectly to these groups that you said are kind of rebranded Al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Shammam?
Well, first, it's multifaceted. For a long time, we turned absolutely a blind eye to our allies' support giving, you know, shipping in weapons and enormous amounts of money to them. You know, someone who was high up in the administration, the early stages of the Syrian war, He told me, he said, well, I said, what did you think you were doing? You know, the Qataris were shipping all this money to people, all this stuff to people who were, you know, who were Al-Qaeda. And he said, well, you know, we sort of tried to, you know, we'd occasionally raise objections and so forth, but they didn't pay attention. And, you know, Qatar, as a population of 2 million, you know, it's this tiny sandbank in the Gulf, which is, you know, largely occupied by a huge American air base, and that, you know, the Qatar wouldn't pay attention to what we were telling them. I don't think so.
Well, let me jump in for just a second here, because I mean, it is a different thing. Providing support is one thing. Turning a blind eye to what our, you know, allies are doing is still not the same as directly providing support.
Well, okay, let's turn to the Saudis. The Saudis, as again, the same high-ranking, he was in the White House at the time, explained to me, he said, well, the Saudis, they wanted to help. They wanted to get in there, but they didn't have the mechanisms for sort of rounding up, you know, for getting third-party supplies of arms. So we helped them. So we, you know, we really facilitated that. So actually what they did was they went and the CIA went and got a load of arms from Croatia and flew them either to Jordan or to Turkey on behalf of the Saudis, and then the Saudis passed them through into their jihadi groups. But then that's one phase of it. Then we've all heard about the rather abortive military train and equip, or whatever it was called, you know, to raise a group of secular, moderate, you know, absolutely vetted, God-fearing, or democracy-loving as much as God-fearing Syrians who would go fight ISIS, and it turned out, after $500 million, they'd produce five of them. What we've heard less about until earlier this year was the CIA program to train, they were called CIA-sponsored moderate groups. And now I'll try and explain to make this simple, how we sort of know what or have an inkling of what happened. Last year, I have to start referring to 2015 as last year, in the spring and summer, there was a very successful offensive against the Syrian army, against the Assad regime in northwestern Syria. And the leading group, it was a group called general sort of coalition called Jaish al-Fatah, Army of Conquest, which was dominated by two of the al-Qaeda spin-offs or renamed al-Qaeda groups, Arar al-Sham and Jabhat al-Nusra. Okay. Mm-hmm. They were very, very well armed, particularly with TOW missiles, American-made TOW missiles. These were supplied through the self-same CIA program, which seems to be mostly based in Jordan, with a branch in Syria. The whole offensive was planned at a CIA, Saudi, Qatari, Turkish coalition command center in a place called Antakya in Turkey. It's true, little groups of these, you know, so-called moderates inside this coalition. But they were simply sort of units inside what was an al-Qaeda coalition. So if you're helping to plan an al-Qaeda offensive, if you're supplying the weapons for an al-Qaeda offensive, if you're, you know, the people that you are directly paying are part of that al-Qaeda offensive, I'd say that constitutes direct support for al-Qaeda.
And you got a U.S. official to admit to you that while Al-Qaeda is not our ally in Syria, it is likely that weapons and support that we are providing are ending up in the hands of Al-Qaeda fighters. And it sounds like there's no particular effort to prevent that.
That's right. I mean, it's, you know, I said to, yes, that's exactly, U.S. officials said exactly that. He said, you know, he's sort of, you know, our ally exactly, but, you know, and, you know, he sort of backed and filed, but conceded that was the point. But there were other interesting examples. For example, the late 2012, there was we did, you know, the so-called Free Syrian Army that we used to hear so much about. It did have some supply, had some arms, you know, its weapons were stored in warehouses in a rebel-controlled border crossing on the Turkish border. Ahrar al-Sham raided the place, took it over, and stole all the weapons. So there was a big meeting the following week in London, of all the outside interested parties, all the West, the British, the French, the Americans, and all the Gulf countries. They're called the London 11, who were basically supervisory sort of foreign powers, you know, involved in the Syrian conflict on the opposition side. And someone said, "Oh, I don't know, it's very bad, Ahrar al-Sham, this group taking over all the Free Syrian Army arms. Shouldn't they be forced to give them back?" And the conference, they all sort of debated it for a few days. And in the end, they said, "No, you know, we won't make any mention of Ahrar al-Sham. We won't condemn them, although, you know, despite demands to do so." So they, I mean, in a way, it sounds like, you know, what's the difference between sort of consent and, you know, actively promoting it? But the net effect has always been to basically to promote and encourage things. And I want to mention something President Obama said last night, which I thought was very telling. He was talking about how America, on issues of global concern, we will mobilize the world to work with us and make sure other countries pull their own weight. That's our approach to conflicts like Syria, where we're partnering with local forces and leading international efforts to help that broken society pursue a lasting peace. Now, that sounds very nice, but the local forces we're partnering with is Al-Qaeda and their backers, i.e. the Qataris, the Turks and the Saudis. I think, you know, that's I thought it was a very telling and rather depressing statement on his part.
Andrew Coburn is with us. He's Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, which has just published an article by him called A Special Relationship. The United States is teaming up with Al-Qaeda again. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Harper's Magazine's Washington editor, Andrew Coburn. He's got a book out called Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. Today, we're talking about his current article in the magazine. It's called A Special Relationship. The United States is teaming up with Al-Qaeda again. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Peter who writes, "My impression is that President Obama resisted congressional calls to arm moderate rebels in Syria. How then did we end up doing it?"
Oh, well, good question. I mean, it's looked like he resisted. Again, it's, well, let me back up. Yes, there were demands from people like particularly Senator McCain and Lindsey Graham and so forth that we should plunge in and supply publicly supply arms to the so-called moderate rebels. I say so-called because people had great difficulty in finding them after the very early stages. So that's all well and good, and people who think we should stay out of such conflicts, you know, applauded, and Obama got marks for that. But meanwhile, as so often happened behind the scenes, it was a slightly different story. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we helped the Saudis obtain a huge amount of arms from Croatia, which went to went to jihadis in Syria. We enabled enabled the Turks to be the sort of rear area, the Pakistan, so to speak, of this war. We did it covertly. I mean, that's what CIA, you know, this has been a very CIA-friendly operation, administration. So what we did was it seemed to be that we were keeping out of the Syrian war as much as possible. In fact, we were playing a very active part.
Is it accurate to label the Muslim Brotherhood a moderate Islamist group?
Well, you know, for a long time, people thought of them as, although they have a long history of violence, and in fact, all the sort of violent jihadi groups we've come to know and love in recent years are all kind of institutionally descended from the Muslim Brotherhood. And, you know, they have a very violent history in places like Syria in the 80s, where they mounted an insurrection and were ruthlessly crushed by the regime. I think what misled people and misled the administration, sort of affected the administration thinking, was the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt in the Mubarak years. Well, you know, I remember you could go and see them and they seemed like very reasonable. Yes, they were sort of Islamist and but they had social services and they delivered, you know, food and medicine to the needy, and you know, it seemed relatively benign. So that when the Arab Spring broke out, which the administration greeted, and a lot of people greeted, but the administration greeted as this was the way, this would be the antidote to extremism. You know, now that the Arab street, Arab youth, and everyone were turning to democracy and all those, you know, all those good things, this would put an end to the war on terror, because we would have won over, because they're adopting our values, the Arab people, particularly young Arab people. So that, you know, and what did they seem to support? Well, they support moderate Islam, like those nice guys in Egypt. So the administration sort of trend, you know, the policy was to go with the Brotherhood. The trouble was that, you know, when in Egypt, the Brotherhood that got elected, partly for the leadership that emerged, partly for accidental reasons, turned out to be very extremist and started sort of pursuing a very sectarian agenda and eventually provoking this coup that, you know, leading to the military takeover in Egypt. But it led to sponsorship of, you know, or indulgence towards Muslim Brotherhood groups in Syria, where it was a different state of affairs. And I'm trying not to make this too complicated, but basically there wasn't a Muslim Brotherhood in Syria on the ground, because they'd really all been killed by the Assads. So that people who call themselves Muslim Brotherhood, I mean, a very different stripe, got armed and got supported instead. It's kind of complicated, and I don't want to sort of give people headaches with the sort of intricacies of Syrian politics in 2011. That's basically what happened. Again, I did, just shifting to a third country, in Turkey, where you had the rise of the AKP, this what seemed like a very decent, moderate Islamist regime who led Turkey in the early 2000s to great, you know, unparalleled economic growth. And, you know, it really seemed like a very, well, it did seem to me, it seemed like a pretty thorough, you know, very beneficial regime, even if the secular traditions in Turkey were being rolled back, and, you know, women being, teachers having to wear heads, encouraged to wear headscarves and all that sort of thing, but that didn't seem to matter. As it turned out, the leadership of the AKP, President Erdogan and his sidekicks, were actually much more extreme. And were very happy to sponsor the jihadi revolution or the jihadi rebels in Syria. It's shades. It's, none of this is completely black and white, but the end result has been very black and white, which is, you know, a terrible civil war in Syria, in which one side with heavy outside support are indeed Al Qaeda.
I want to ask you a serious question, Andrew. And I know that you've been doing this for decades and you are well-versed in all the things you're talking about. But when you're talking to people who have very different perceptions on the same thing, who may view the truth in different ways or simply have an agenda that they would like to push, can you talk a little bit about what it takes for you as a journalist to untangle this, to feel confident that what the way you understand something to be is in fact the way it is?
Well, you know, no one is, you know, we all bring our orientation to a discussion. I mean, everyone has an ideology. It's, you know, it's how you make sense of the world around you. So, you know, I'm certainly not going to pretend that I live in a completely sort of, you know, zero centigrade sort of world of, you know, absolute dispassionate facts. I will say that, you know, I have, you know, I've been doing this, as you mentioned, for a very long time, and, you know, very close to that region. I've been to Syria a number of times. I've been to Iraq quite a number of times, to Lebanon. So I will claim a feeling about this. I mean, there certainly are many people with as much experience as me who will disagree vehemently with what I've been saying. I just see, I mean, what led me to write this article and to talk the way I have been doing to you is, so everyone has tended to, people have kind of have short memories. Everyone's forgotten what happened in, you know, what the Afghan war in the 1980s was about and what happened in it. And to see the same excuses, you know, remembering what we were being told then about, how the moderate, we don't control what's going on. That the most of the rebels are moderate, you know, all that, to hear the same, sound like the same game plan being instituted again was what led me to start looking into this. So I think I will claim that I usually have a sense of history on my side in these discussions. But it's true. I mean, only this morning I was discussing with someone who said, how can you talk this way? Assad is, you know, is really, Assad is the one who's supporting the Al Qaeda and ISIS in Syria because they never fight each other. Well, that's a very common thing you hear a lot of, but it's just not true. You know, you look at any map or look at, you know, any recent account of the fighting, and you can see that. For example, we've heard a lot about Palmyra, this wonderful ancient city which was taken over by ISIS. And they've been busily blowing up the temples and, you know, selling off the artifacts. Well, that was taken from the Syrian army, and they beheaded a good number of Syrian army soldiers that they captured in the process. I mean, all along that front line, not everywhere, but wherever, you know, ISIS is in contact with the Syrian army in a number of places, and they fight very bitterly. The Syrian army recently recaptured... not between Palmyra and Aleppo, they recently recaptured a vital airfield which had been taken by ISIS. I won't bore you with all this, but there's a great deal of combat between the two. And yet this myth, you hear this mantra all the time is, oh, Assad doesn't fight ISIS, which is just not true.
How has the rise of ISIS, of the Islamic State, shifted perceptions of Al-Qaeda and what it's capable of doing or interested in doing?
Well, it's had an interesting effect. I mean, in that, since ISIS is so determinedly horrible, you know, that they, all the public executions and, you know, they burning people alive and all that. I mean, it's so everyone else kind of looks, it's easier to see other, everyone else is looking good by comparison. So that the, you know, there's been this definite drive by the groups I've been talking about, by particularly by Ahrar al-Sham and al-Nusra, you know, that they're a kinder, gentler kind of, you know, Islamist extremists, and we shouldn't worry so much about them. But actually they go in, I don't know about heading, but they're just as busy executing captives and so forth. And an example I quote in the piece was when this army of conquest that we, you know, we were so happy with, took this very large area of western Syria in the spring and summer, their first act, you know, was to institute Sharia law, of course. Al-Nusra started massacring Druze and telling all the other Druze they better convert on pain of death. All the Christians very wisely fled as fast as possible, leading to, you know, part of the refugee surge that we've been talking, we hear so much about. Ahrar al-Sham, I noticed, they instituted in the main towns a little ceremony every Friday, which was public floggings of anyone who skipped Friday prayers.
Wow.
These were the people who looked good by comparison. So it's, then there was another interesting example quite recently. There was a leader of another group called Jaish al-Islam, which had been mostly armed by the Saudis. Their leader was a chap called Alush, who, when he was meeting Western reporters, used to act nice and say how he believed in, you know, democracy and rights for everyone. When he was talking not to Western reporters, he would express his dream of expelling all Shiites and Alawites from Damascus and also preside over mass executions of things. Anyway, he was killed in either a Syrian or Russian airstrike. I mean, this guy was a fanatical, sectarian, bloodthirsty zealot. No two ways about it. There were all these sort of almost sort of lamentations among Western commentators. Oh, one of the hopes for peace has gone in Syria. Assad doesn't want anyone, you know, between him and ISIS. You know, moderate elements are being wiped out. And I couldn't believe what I was reading. You know, that this Alush, he was a terrible fellow. And yet, because he wasn't ISIS, and because he'd occasionally make some lip service about tolerance or something, we were all happy to have him around. And, you know, our good allies, the Saudis, were busily arming and funding him.
Are the Saudis and Qataris somehow indirectly helping ISIS?
Well, that's the big question. I quote in the piece a former head of MI6 of British intelligence who certainly said he couldn't see how they weren't, couldn't see how they couldn't be getting money. I mean, yes, let me think. Also, one thing people who tend to sort of tell it fairly straight are the U.S. Treasury. If you look at their terrorist lists of people who they've sanctioned, there's a list called the SDN, Specially Designated National. And you look up who people that U.S. intelligence considers terrorists, and there's a whole bunch of Qataris, or several Qataris on there, and Saudis, who are, you know, on that list because they've been acting as ISIS enablers or fundraisers, ISIS and Al Qaeda. And there's one, his name's gone out of my head, who's simultaneously the secretary of the Qatari Soccer Federation, presumably have a big role in the World Cup, and he's on the list as an Al-Qaeda and ISIS fundraiser. So, you know, they could say, the governments would say with their hands on their hearts, of course not, we wouldn't, you know, give them any money. On the other hand, you know, somehow money seems to flow out of it. For a while, the Kuwaiti Minister of Justice was featuring on al-Nusra recruitment and fundraising posters. So, you know, it's a very porous, you know, the Gulf is a good place for al-Qaeda and ISIS to raise money, clearly.
Andrew Coburn is Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. His article, A Special Relationship, The United States is Teaming Up with Al-Qaeda Again, appears in the current issue of Harper's. Andrew, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Well, thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Tori Whitley. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.